I'm going to consider that the official start then. So my name is Mary Krogan. I'm Executive Director of the Research Grants Program Office, of which we've got several people here and several others on the phone. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Mel Cavanaugh Lynch. Mel is Director of the California Breast Cancer Research Program and should be speaking today on breast cancer. But let me tell you some more about the program, and I will keep this brief, and also Mel's qualifications. So in this position, Mel develops the strategies and guides the priorities for the 15th year that we award in breast cancer research funds to agencies in the state. Her accomplishments include championing the role of advocates and survivors in our peer review process, grant applications, developing a successful model for funding community-based participatory research, and developing a rigorous evaluation process for the breast cancer research program. In recent years, she led a national panel that developed research strategies to explore the role of environmental contaminants in breast cancer, and is now implementing those research strategies through the CBCRP. And just to let you know, this has made such a national impact. It's been picked up by the Institute of Medicine, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, and several other groups, with California leading the way. And Mel and Vet Larry and Katie and others from the program here who can take credit as well. Mel's commitment to bringing women's voices into research and decisions about research drew her to the California Breast Cancer Research Program, a program that arose and continues to grow from the energy, wisdom, and dreams of women with breast cancer. It's with great pleasure that I introduce Dr. Mel Cavanaugh Lynch and our series of Women We Admire. So thanks, Mel.
Thank you. For those of you on the telephone, you probably don't know this, but I will be using slides, and you can see those slides if you use your computer to go to writingtalk.com and use the same phone number as the passcode to get into that site, and then you'll see the slides. So the topic today is breast cancer screening, should I or shouldn't I? There are a few people in the room for whom that answer is probably obvious, but to make this a little more interesting, as I'm saying breast cancer, you can substitute prostate cancer, and it'll be pretty much the same story. So first I want to tell you a little bit about the California Breast Cancer Research Program. We were created in 1993 by the California State Legislature, largely through the efforts of breast cancer advocates and breast cancer survivors around the state who wanted the state to be making investment in addressing this epidemic. The legislation added 2 cents per pack to the cigarette tax and designated that tax for 2 purposes, breast cancer screening and breast cancer research. Half of the pot goes into research, and 90% of that research pot comes to us at the California Breast Cancer Research Program. And then we distribute those funds in research grants throughout the state. I should also make you aware that we also are the recipient of the funds on the state tax checkoff form. On your state income tax form, there's a place where you can donate money to a number of different causes, one of them being breast cancer, and that money comes to us. And we also get private donations. So why at UCOP? The legislation actually requested that the University of California administer this program. There were 2 existing health research programs within UCOP. The tobacco-related disease research program, and what was then the university-wide AIDS research program. There was precedent, and the UC is considered the official research arm of the state, so that was the reason for putting the program here. We were housed in the Office of Health Affairs in special research programs from 1994 until 2008, and then in 2008 we were transferred over to the Office of Research and Graduate Studies and the Research Grant Program Office. So what do we do? As I said, we basically give out grants. Since 1993, we've given out over $213 million in research grants around the state. We're approaching 1,000 grants that we've given out in that period. And one of the most remarkable things, I think, is that we've given out grants to 101 different institutions across the state of California. So one of the great things about having this program in a state like California is what other state has 101 research institutions that do breast cancer research? We fund in a wide variety of areas, including very basic science and examining the biology of breast cancer and the breast cell. We funded prevention and risk reduction, diagnosis and treatment, and in community impact of breast cancer. So, back to our topic. So, how many of you have heard that you should start mammograms yearly at 40? Okay, quite a few of you. How many of you have heard that you should get mammograms every other year starting at 50? Not a lot of the same people. So, how many of you think the scientists should, like, quit fooling around and figure out what the heck we should do and actually answer our questions and give us great advice? No one's raising their hand. All right. So, they haven't yet, so I'm not going to give you an answer at the end, but I hope that at the end of this talk you'll have a much better sense of why you might not, and be able to make a more informed decision. So I've frequently struck when I see ads on television or ads in magazines about mammograms, and these are quotes from actual ads promoting mammography screening. The thing that strikes me is, you know those drug ads that where there's the fine print that's about at the end of the TV commercial and the person speaking really fast? You should be aware this drug may cause blah, 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 blah. You know, those advertisements for mammography have none of that fun. Isn't that interesting? So we talk a lot about the benefits of mammography, but we actually very rarely, really until recently, start talking about the risks of mammography and why you might not want to do it. So if you've read these statements, you might think, of course I need a mammogram. Why only once a year? Shouldn't I do it once a month? Shouldn't I do it once a year? So, there are some myths. There are many myths about breast cancer, about breast cancer screening. These are a few that I hope by the end of this talk you'll be able to refute in an intelligent way. So, the first, I think the word's getting out about this, but and I would say this is actually physicians and scientists' fault, this idea that mammograms can prevent breast cancer. And it comes from this scientific way of looking at prevention that epidemiologists talk about primary prevention, secondary prevention, and tertiary prevention, and then they just talk about prevention, lump those all together. Secondary prevention is preventing death from the disease. And that's where screening can be useful, and so that screening, mammography is actually a secondary prevention tool, and therefore, when people start talking about breast cancer prevention, we don't really have much to say about primary prevention. They start talking about mammography is prevention. Well, it's not. It doesn't really prevent breast cancer at all. It helps you find it. But actually, in a survey in 2003, 57% of Americans answered yes, that they thought that mammograms prevented breast cancer. So, a very common myth. I'm going to get into this a bit more, but it actually is not the case that cancer found by mammography is by definition early and therefore can be cured through our current treatment methods. It's also not the case that all breast cancers can be found early and cured. There are risks to mammography, which I'm going to talk about. And there is actually risk to all the things that happen if you have a mammogram that are found to have an abnormal mammogram. So, there's this phrase that has really entered our lexicon, early detection saves lives. Is there anyone here who doesn't believe that? It has become a standard phrase that really everyone has accepted that isn't always the case, actually. So, and something interesting has happened, I think, more in breast cancer than in other diseases, where there's this early late distinction. So I think it goes something like this. So we do know, you should know, so all cancers are, when they're diagnosed, are staged. And the staging is all very similar. Stage one means it's small, it hasn't spread anywhere, it's, you know, you can cut it out, you can ablate it, you can get rid of it fairly easily. Stage four means the cancer has already spread throughout your body. And stage two and three are between those two things. That's true for all cancers. So it is true, by definition, that a woman with stage one breast cancer will do better and live longer than a woman with stage four breast cancer. So the statement, women whose cancers are detected at a lower stage will do better than cancers, women whose cancers are detected at a later stage, at a higher stage, is a true statement. That became a shortcut where people then talked instead of a lower stage and a more advanced stage or a higher stage, they started talking about early stage and late stage, which then kind of translated to this, you have an early breast cancer, you have a late breast cancer, and this implicit message that if you have a late breast cancer, it means you should have done something sooner. If you had done something sooner, you would now have an early breast cancer instead of a late one. I hope I'll convince you that all makes sense, right? I mean, can you see the logic? That's actually not what's going on. So, this is a conventional view of breast cancer. So this is what I learned when I went to medical school about the development of breast cancer. So you start here with normal breast cells, and then some things happen, and you get some abnormal cells, and you go along, your cells get more abnormal, and then you get this DCIS, which stands for ductal carcinoma in situ, which is basically cancer that hasn't started to invade yet. And then you actually get invasive breast cancer, and then the invasive breast cancer spreads throughout the body and metastasizes. And that's the conventional view of how breast cancer develops. So in screening, what you want to do is catch cancers down at this end, and then you'll never end up with an inflammatory invasive breast cancer, or if you catch it here, you will end up with metastatic breast cancer. If that theory played out, then as you started screening populations of women, you would see a reduction in metastatic breast cancer. You might actually see an increase in these things, but that increase would be balanced by a decrease in the late stage of metastatic breast cancer. So I'm going to show you what's actually happened in two different cancers in our country over the last 30 years. This is cervical cancer here. And you can see that cervical cancer has plummeted from what, compared to breast cancer, are still relatively low rates, but to, you know, a third of the original rate in the 70s. And actually, I would have liked to find a kind of curve that started in the 50s, because that's when PAP screening started. And the mortality rate, which is the lower blue line, has also gone down to less than half of what it was in the 70s. Well, we've kind of done the same thing with breast cancer a little later, but we started doing all the screening and all this treatment, and now, you know, on the order of 85% of women are getting screened for breast cancer, and we're not seeing that same plummet. We're actually seeing the rates of breast cancer, the upper black line, increase, and the death rates from breast cancer, the lower blue line, have been pretty much rock solid until fairly recently. And even the recent dip has been a fairly small dip. So we're not seeing that classic, what we would expect if screening were successful, pattern. So back before we had screening, in the old days, you could basically talk about two types of women in terms of breast cancer, women who do not have cancer and women who are found to have cancer. Before screening, usually found by a lump or a mass in the breast. Once we started screening, then we got into this, women don't have cancer, then women with early breast cancer and women with late breast cancer. And again, some sense of blame for these women with late breast cancer. Now, as screening has become commonplace and been adopted throughout this country, this bizarre thing has happened. So as I explained, what you would have expected to see is that this group of women with late breast cancer would actually shrink and do screen the population. And you might see an increase in the women with early breast cancer, but that increase would be coming from this women with light breast cancer. Instead, it's actually coming from that group of women who don't have cancer. Something is amiss here. So this is now a diagram that shows you the same thing. These are three lines for the three different types of breast cancer. Local, which would be a stage one, regional, which would be a stage two or three, and distant, which would be a stage four. You can see that since 1976, the incidence of local stage one cancers, early cancers, has climbed quite remarkably, while the incidence of distant cancers has really not budged. So, this is a theoretical explanation for why that could be the case. So, I'll explain a couple things about this chart. So, the x-axis on the bottom is time. These arrows up here are when a woman goes through screening. So let's say this is a chart for a theoretical woman who starts screening at 50 and does it every other year, so she's 50 here, 52 here, 54, 56, 58, 60. For theoretical tumors, tumor A is a tumor that stays microscopic throughout this whole decade and can never be seen on a mammogram. It never becomes a health problem. And so it remains undetected. It also remains unharmful to the woman that it's living in. Tumor B is a slightly faster growing tumor. So it starts in maybe 30s and 40s, in a woman's 30s and 40s, and grows along and she's getting screened, but it's not being seen for several screenings, until it crosses this threshold into actually being no longer just microscopic, but still contained in the breast. And she gets a screening, and then she gets treated. She goes on and does well. Well, if you follow this curve out, you can see that actually she hadn't gotten screened here and hadn't gotten treated here. This cancer probably might never have been felt. Would never have caused her any problems, would not have harmed her health in any way. Tumor C is a faster growing tumor and kind of follows the same pattern. You don't see it in a few screenings and then you do see it. And she gets treated. You see, she hadn't been treated, but by the time she got screened again, she would already have metastatic disease and would not have a very good prognosis. So screening in this case was a good idea. And then finally is tumor D, which is so fast aggressive and fast growing that it appears it becomes metastatic in between two screenings. So, again, these are theories. But we actually think this may be the case. And here's some of the evidence for it being the case. This slide, the top part, shows genotyping of different women's tumors. And through the wonders of supercomputers and being able to analyze massive amounts of data and to be able to sequence massive numbers of genes in a short period of time, researchers have been able to start to group cancers into different subtypes. The names of the subtypes here don't really mean that you can ignore those. What you should be taking away is that there are groups of tumors that behave similarly and that behave different than other groups of tumors. Now, the reason why we need to do some research is that these gray ones in between are ones that don't fall in any of them. Don't really understand them yet. So the bottom half is the survival curve for a sample of these women. So in a survival plot, what happens every time there's a drop down, that means the woman died. So the line staying up near the top here is a good thing. This means that most of these women are continue to be alive at 7 years after diagnosis, 8 years. So this is the luminal subtype A, the dark blue line. But you can see that the women with these other types of cancers don't do nearly as well. Well, these are probably more like that tumor D that we showed you in the last slide, and these are more like the tumor maybe B. It gets detected, but women still do remarkably well after that diagnosis. This is some of the scientific evidence, this theory about different cancers acting differently is actually the case.
Can I interrupt for one second? Do you want to tell them about ReadyTalk.com for new people who come on?
Sure. For those of you who may have just joined us on the call, the slides have been projected on ReadyTalk.com. You just enter the same, once you get to their website, you just enter the same phone number into the login, and you'll see the slides.
So, Mel, are there two curves that are superimposed? Because there's five types.
This is normal breast.
This is normal breast.
Not there.
So it's the one straight across.
Right.
Okay. So let's talk about the different things that can happen when a woman goes in for a mammogram. So one outcome is that she gets a mammogram, she gets told you have a normal mammogram, there's no evidence of cancer, go home. Good thing. I do have to make a little caveat that mammograms can actually miss cancers, so that doesn't necessarily mean she doesn't have cancer. But okay, alternatively, she can be told, oh, you know what, your mammogram's not normal. We're not quite sure what's going on here. So we need to do some more tests. We need to get some different views of your, so do another mammogram, do a couple more pictures, and then maybe do an ultrasound. We might want to do an MRI, and then we might want to have a biopsy. But in this group of women, then whatever additional tests she has, they say, oh, it's all okay, no cancer. Then you can, another outcome is that they say, oh, you have cancer, and then they treat you. And I'll get into the details of this. And then let's say this woman is tumor C on that curve. This is the one where you catch it in time. It was going to harm her if you didn't catch it, so you've done this woman a lot of good. And then there's a group of women who you have not done a lot of good for, and there's sort of three types. One is that tumor B, that one that was never going to actually impact a woman's life. You haven't really helped her. Then there's a tumor, if you have a tumor in between B and C, that, okay, it was, you caught it, and it needed to be treated, but if you had waited until that woman felt a lump, she would have been fine waiting until then, and then having her surgery and treatment, and her outcome would not have been any different. And then finally, there's a group of women that, despite all of this, still end up succumbing to breast cancer. So, you've got these three women with happy faces. They're happy because they went through their mammogram, they were told they had an early cancer, they were treated, they should do well. No one's happy going through the treatment, but they're happier than they would have if they told, oh, you should have done that, and you didn't. But the reality is, the only person that actually helped in this scenario is woman down there in the bottom left. So the woman who got treated before her cancer could get bad and did well. The rest of them actually have not benefited from the screening at all. We'll get into that a bit more. So what are the harms that are suffered by women going through screening? So same group of women. So the woman who goes in and gets told, your mammogram's normal, you can go home, come back in 2 years. Really the only harm that she has suffered is whatever anxiety she has leading up to getting that mammogram. And then the radiation from the mammogram itself. Now, radiation today for mammograms is very low. But it's one of the things we think about. Because one mammogram is very low. You start at 50, you go every other year. If you don't stop when you're 70, then you live to 100, that's 25 mammograms that start to add up. If you start when you're 40, and you go every year and you live to 100, that's 60 mammograms. It's starting to add up even more. If you then have a CAT scan because of some other issue, if you have radiation therapy for any issue, then your radiation dose starts to increase. And really one of the very, very few things we know causes breast cancer is radiation. So the second woman, the one who got told she had an abnormal mammogram, but no cancer. So she's cancer-free, she's pretty happy, but she had to go through radiation. Then she had to go through the anxiety of being called back for new views. She had to go through more radiation. She may have had to go through getting a biopsy. All of this very anxiety-provoking. Now, the third one, I think we all agree that, yeah, she has the same risks, but the benefits that she got clearly outweigh the risks. For this group of women over here, who all were told they had cancer and then were treated, but it didn't change their outcome. These women have all gone through the radiation, the anxiety, the biopsy, and then the surgery, the radiation therapy, the chemotherapy, and it didn't change their outcome at all. Those are some pretty big risks. So you have to kind of think, well, but how many women actually have carried these different risks? So I'm going to talk about a theoretical group of 2,500 women who start screening at 50, is screened for 20 years, so every other year, so 10 mammograms. So it's 2,500 women, it's 25,000 mammograms. Same groups of women, and here are the numbers as best we can tell from the studies that have been done thus far. So 1,500 of the 2,500 will be told every year, your mammogram's fine, go home. They're a happy group, and it's a big group, a big chunk of those women. But 1,000 of those women will be told at some point in that 20 years, oh, you have an abnormal mammogram, come back. Approximately 500 of that 1,000 will end up with a biopsy. Remember, those 1,000 are all the ones who don't have cancer, so they've gone through more mammograms, more tests, and a biopsy, and just find out that they don't have cancer. The estimate is that it takes screening 2,500 women for 20 years to save one woman's life. So that one happy woman is what results from screening. And then this estimate gets a little mushier, but somewhere, it's depending upon which study you believe the most, between 5 and 15 women of the 2,500 will end up being diagnosed with cancer, going through full treatment, and having no change in their outcome. What they went through. Now, the thing that gets really tricky here is that between the cancer that's only treatable when detected preclinically, the cancers that would have not been that, and the cancer that would have been treated successfully later. Those three groups of people, three women who all got told they had cancer, or three groups of women, we're all pulled into cancer, all went through therapy, we can't tell them apart. So for any individual woman, we can't tell you what group you're in. So you know what? All three of those groups of women will tell you, I'm so glad I got a mammogram, that mammogram saved my life. And they all believe it. And they have no reason not to believe it. Because we can't tell them otherwise. I hope it helps you understand now why there are some incredibly strong emotional reactions to some of the changes in the recommendation. You have large groups of women who have been through this experience and who are totally convinced to save their life. So, what do we know today? Where the direction that things are going in now is less you must get screening. So the phrase the American Cancer Society used in the 80s in promoting screening that said, if you haven't had a mammogram, you need more than just your breasts examined. We no longer think that, or many of us no longer think that. Screening actually is something that you have to weigh the risks and benefits, and different women are going to make different choices. And they're both reasonable, rational choices. So the decision about whether to undergo screening really is a close call. It's not the obvious, I can't believe you didn't do it thing that we used to think it was. And then here's where the arguments come in. Some people think, well, then you tell, well, you give women the facts and you let them make their own decisions, informed decision making. It is what I believe in. But there are other people who will argue just as vociferously that there is a benefit, even though it's a modest benefit, and so we should just keep telling women to get screened. So what should you do after today? So I'm not going to give you the answer. You need to think, make your own choices, knowing now a little bit more about the risks and benefits of screening, about whether screening is right for you. And you should make that decision in concert with your healthcare provider. And then you'll have to judge about your healthcare provider depending upon how they lead you through that discussion. If they say, what are you talking about, you idiot? How could you even consider not having one? Then you might want to consider a different healthcare provider. Hopefully you won't run into that. If you choose to get screened, go ahead and do it. And just understand the risks. And understand if you end up in one of those pathways, that you're in one of those pathways, and you actually that you probably can't tell you which one you're in. As a side note, that genetic profiling that I showed you earlier is actually out in clinical practice now, and it does help us now, to some extent, sort people out. And so you can take a biopsy, you can do the genetic profiling on the biopsy, and to some extent, sort people out is like, look, based on the genetic profiling, you are likely to do very well without getting chemotherapy. Don't get it. It's not 100%. And so some women will say, I don't care if it's 99%, then I still want chemotherapy because I want to have that 1% advantage. Again, a personal choice. Whether you engage in screening or not, if you feel a lump in your breast, in a breast, or any other changes, you should get them checked out. There really is good evidence that finding something and getting it treated at that point can also be a benefit. And finally, if you get diagnosed with breast cancer and you haven't been doing screening, don't beat yourself up. Realize that even if you had been doing screening, it probably would not have changed you. Statistically, it would not change your outcome. It wouldn't change what happens to you in the future. So I would invite you to view our website where you can find lots of research results and other topics in other areas. And I'm happy to take questions.
For the phone. Hopefully they've got it on the slide pulled up. But the website's www.cabreastcancer.org.
So questions? Cameron?
Fascinating talk. Thank you very much for inviting us. Two questions that come to my mind. The biology background. I think the basal subtype that you showed the from the genetic profile point of view, from clinically significant perspective, is there enough there to actually to screen women as a sort of, I would say, as an alternative from mammograms. And say, so if you were to do a GWAS or a genome-wide analysis and come up with these subtypes that are much more sort of believable, prominent from a clinical point of view, have you actually replaced that? Or, I mean, I'm just trying to, I guess my question is the state of the art in terms of basic breast cancer research as of today. Are there efforts in place where people are trying to actually nail that from GWAS perspective? Because that's actually what I would think would be outstanding achievement in terms of replacing the entire requirement to do mammography. And then just say, you know, and I'm not actually, my second part of my question was, before you answer, is, of course, the genetic profiling is just one aspect. We are all born with certain genes, but the environmental aspect of it, how much would that, do you think, matter if you were to...
Okay, so there's something I need to make clear about the genetic profiling. That is not, that is genetic profiling of tumors. So this is not something that, this is not a genetic test that you or I can take to predict what kind of tumor we would get if we got a tumor. These are not genes that are gene abnormalities that are in the tumor only.
Right, and that's why I said if you take it and go to GWAS, where you actually do the normal test, how some of these genes get activated and why, what are the factors, are they genetic factors or environmental factors? I think that's where I was trying to go.
Understanding how those pathways get activated and how some of those gene expressions change in a tumor is kind of the crux of cancer biology, and something we actually have not made much progress in. What actually makes those changes, what makes that ball start to roll?
Right.
And it's an open question.
So, do you expect that there would come a day when, if a woman receives a diagnosis of breast cancer, that they will be able to say, just going back to your slide that showed tumor A, B, C, and D, you've got B? Or, you know, will they be able to say, you have, your tumor is the kind that will go grow very, very slowly. You don't have to worry about it. Or
I think
will it always be a guessing game? Do you think so?
Well,
yes,
hope so. So I think actually we are moving very rapidly to the point where we will understand more and more. And so we'll be able to tell you, but it'll never be 100% certainty. So we'll be able to say, your tumor, 84% of them look like a B. 16% don't. So then, you know, then you've got choices to make. But I think we're actually very close to that point. As I said, some of these tests are already in clinical practice. They're already considered standards of clinical practice in different scenarios. And, you know, there's a lot about those tests. They're different ones. None of them work well for everything. But they're going to get better and harder. So I think it already is the case that women are being diagnosed with breast cancer and then being told, you know, surgery and radiation should be enough. You don't have to do anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that will make a big impact on decreasing the massive overtreatment that most of us think we're doing to women now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do risk factors play into this? People talk about family history or whether or not you've been pregnant. How do those things relate to some of the information you've shared today?
We don't know. So as you're obviously aware, there are lists of risk factors for breast cancer, for developing breast cancer. You should also be aware that, and this percentage is also in some debate, but probably about 70% of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer don't have any of the risk factors except the one of being a woman and getting older. The two things we kind of are born doing, right? Whether different risk factors predispose to different types, we don't understand that. Remember, those different types I showed you were theoretical types. And then the genetic profiling are, you know, actual types we've been able to distinguish, but only very recently. So we haven't been able to then look at what are the risk factors for that type versus this type versus another type. And there may very well be different risk factors for different types.
Everything. Great talk, Mel. So from the policy standpoint, there was this great eruption of distress from the broader community when federal panelists studied research and said, maybe we don't need to test so often. And they were accused of allowing, you know, cost savings, driving the decisions. Where is the policymaking community now in light of this very interesting and very sobering analysis?
So the policy changes were really not that dramatic. So the U.S. Preventive Task Force has looked at mammography a number of times, like 6-7 times over the last 20 years. Really, they have always recommended every other year after age 50. Until the last time they looked at it, in 2002, when some people think that they bowed to political pressure at that time to say, well, 40. Even when they said 40, they said, well, there's no good evidence for 40, but we're recommending 40. So the U.S. Preventive Health Task Force really has not moved that much. They moved, like, maybe, but that's not the perception. And I think one of the things that feeds that perception is there clearly is, you know, another place people get advice from is the American Cancer Society, which has not budged, and which actually was recommending 40 annually long before there was any science, and any scientists thought that it was a good idea. But you have two major bodies that people listen to saying different things. It's going to create confusion, and there's a lot of emotion in this issue. So you take two strong sides and a lot of emotion, and you saw what happened.
Why would they recommend every year at 40?
I mean, what's the motivation? Is it, you know, cell machines that do mammographies? Or, you know, I hear a lot of conjecturing about that.
Do you want me to respond?
Sure.
So a friend of mine was the chair of the 2002 task force, and one of my mentors was the chair of this one, Diana Petiti, on the 2009. So I actually lived through both of these controversies. In 2002, they actually made a hard and fast recommendation, and then Congress called them in and made them do about 3 days of testimony, all the while being challenged by the American Cancer Society and by the companies that make mammography machines and so forth. And it basically became, we may not let you release the report. We may not even fund you guys to continue to exist unless you back down. So it was a matter of the information hadn't changed. Their recommendation hadn't changed. But as Mel said, they basically said, well, if you want to start at 40, start at 40. But we still think you shouldn't start till you're 50. The difference was Diana Petiti, who was the last one, has got the thickest skin of any scientist I've ever known in my life. And Diana was willing to stand up and not back down and have the support of her committee to just take the slings and arrows and bullets that were shot at them for sticking to the 50 mark this time. So it was, in my mind, 100% political, not science, not evidence-based, not anything else when they backed off before.
But it's, you know, so I didn't get into this issue, but I assume that most of you have heard that breast self-exam is also no longer promoted, recommended. And I was on the American Cancer Society's Breast Health Task Force at the time when ACS decided to accept that and stop doing the something one, teach one.
No, teach one, teach one?
Do one, teach one, whatever, yeah.
ACS had a whole program on instructing women in breast self-exam, which their volunteers ran and created. And when ACS decided to shut that program down, it was massive uproar from the women who were doing this. And, you know, you kind of understand it. It's the danger, actually, I think, of not giving people the pluses and minuses of things. So I do think ACS tends to come out with a statement and say, this is the statement, and not give a weighted, and a, you know, well, you could go this way, you could go that way. You do that to masses of women, and you convince them, BSC, breast self-exam is going to save the masses. Go forth and teach. And you run that program for 10 years, and they say, oh, never mind. No one likes to be told that what they've been doing the last 10 years and devoting tons of volunteer time to and tons of effort to was worthless, and you shouldn't do it anymore. So it's not very, I don't find the reaction surprising. And I think the same thing happens, you know, there's now a federal program, there has been for 15 years now, a federal program to promote screening in underserved communities. And there's tons of infrastructure set up everywhere, agencies who exist to promote screening in underserved communities. And again, tell them, well, actually, what you've been doing is not the right thing, and we're going to have you stop doing it now, is really difficult. So, you know, I don't think it's just about the makers of mammography machines wanting to make money and just about industry influence on ACS and things like that. I think there are a lot of factors involved, which are, you know, very real human factors. But it's what gets you in trouble when you make blanket statements and don't say, well, you know, we hope this is helping and we think it might help and keep people informed.
So the effect of radiation over the years, is there any, you know, studies to give guidance on, like, well, when you get to this age, maybe even if you've had breast cancer, you should stop because your radiation load is getting to a certain level or anything like that? Or
No. So, again, the U.S. Preventive Health Task Force and much of the evidence says stop screening at 70 or 75. They say that because there's no, in the studies, there has been no evidence that you extend life by doing screening after age 75. But the whole issue of how much radiation does it take to cause a breast cancer, no one can get at. I think scientists have really gotten to the point where they can say there is no safe level of radiation. So every time you get radiation, I mean, there is no safe level. So you really shouldn't get it unless benefits outweigh the risks. And so it's, you know, each one, and, you know, I've heard people, and I'm actually pretty intrigued by this idea, recommend that we all have a radiation badge that we take to all of our medical tests so that we actually get a measure of how much radiation we're getting. But you know, the use of CAT scans and other tests are used, you know, pretty freely these days. And people who are really hooked into the medical system can get an awful lot of tests.
There are some good data available. Like I worked for many years at a place where I wore a radiation badge all the time. So number of employees, number of years, there's a lot of data. And people have a hard time finding really that much risk involved with fact with low-level radiation. And it doesn't seem to be a big enough effect that at least people can detect it with the numbers that they have, and it could be happening. I mean, you know, there's lots of different levels of radiation. People that are flight attendants or pilots, they get a lot of low level radiation. People that live in Denver get more low level radiation than you do, and people have tried to find correlations between these things, and they haven't been able to find it. There's lots of research on the survivors of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, where what happened to people who got really high doses of radiation, but as you go out from ground zero, there's lower and lower levels of radiation, and when you go out, the cancer rates really dropped off really fast. It's not a linear progression. And so from that, although it's a single dose, so you can't necessarily compare apples and oranges, you find that the low-level radiation doesn't seem to have that much effect. And aside from thyroid cancer and the Chernobyl event, which is mostly affecting children, people can't find very much effect from that either.
People don't like to hear that. It's very complicated because, so in the Japanese bomb experience, in the breast cancer experience was that the people who were at highest risk for breast cancer were the women who were in their early teens at the time of exposure and then got breast cancer in their 40s and 50s and 60s. So there hasn't been, since the Chernobyl accident, we haven't had enough time to actually see that sort of exposure.
Yeah.
And flight attendants actually do have a documented increased risk of breast cancer. Now, what a lot of people will say is, in terms of mammography and the risk of radiation from a mammogram, the studies all look at what are the numbers of lives saved if you do a mammogram versus you don't. So in the ones that you're doing mammograms, you're saving lives and possibly also causing cancers, but the end result is a better end result. So even if you're causing cancers, you're saving more lives than you're causing. But that still doesn't really answer the question. And then the last thing, again, the age seems to be a big factor. So what another group that people are very worried about are younger women who know they carry one of the genes that puts them at very high risk for breast cancer. If you start screening those women in their 20s and 30s, what are you doing to their breasts? We don't know. And people actually do worry about the radiation risk in those cases.
Are there any other questions? Rosemary, do you want to do the drawing?
Oh, yes, and I think we all would like to say thank you.
Yeah,
first. So, Mel, we are a volunteer organization with a microscopic budget. so
we would like
you.
To thank you for coming to speak, and
this
is what we can offer you. Thank you. And then if everyone who would like to participate in the raffle has already put their name in, then we can have somebody draw from the vote. Does everyone put their name? Okay. So with the Giants fan. Okay.
That's right, you won. All right, so thank you all for coming. Thanks for those who participated on Ready Talk, and thank you, Mel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.